Hello, everyone. This is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent U.S. citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? Felton Eugene Henderson is one of America's most iconic judges and civil rights activists. And so I began our Keen on America conversation with Judge Henderson, which took place in his Berkeley, California home, by asking him when and where he was born.
My name is Felton Henderson. I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana in 1933. And shortly thereafter, when I was 3 years old, my family moved to South Central Los Angeles. That's where I grew up and came of age.
I asked him whether he felt part of that generation of African Americans who, in the depths of the Great Depression, moved from the South to California.
Oh my gosh, I really do, yes. And I've recently referred to it. I think that I was saying that one of my great fortunes in life was that when I was 3 years old, my grandmother, who had seven children, including my mother, of course, decided to bring us all to Los Angeles, and sort of not unlike the Joad family in Grapes of Wrath, we put all our belongings on a big truck, followed by a car behind, and we all came to South Central LA, and I think that made a much better life for me than growing up in Shreveport, Louisiana, in the Jim Crow era.
I asked him about Jim Crow. When did he become aware of the term, and what did it mean to him?
I first became aware of the term Jim Crow and the way things were in the South. As I was growing up, I'd hear stories from the family, learn things such as that my grandmother's grandparents were slaves, and she has fairly vivid memories of that. Various relatives would tell me about the tough times in Louisiana and prior to that in Mississippi. So I was aware of racism in the South. And interestingly enough, it was all limited to the South, although when I became even older, I realized that I was experiencing on a daily basis another form of racism in South Central Los Angeles. But I learned of Jim Crow probably not until I got to college and started studying political science and other kinds of things.
I asked him about his sense of his own identity. As he was growing up, did he think of himself as an American or as an African American?
Very good question. I think I thought of myself as just a grammar school, junior high school kid growing up and going to school and just growing up to be whatever I was going to become. I was aware of the racial differences, and I was aware that there were places and things that I couldn't go to, but somehow they didn't really register.
I asked him if his family believed in the idea of the American dream.
You know, I don't think they did, except my mother. My mother was different. As I said, there were seven kids in the family that my grandmother had, they didn't believe in the American dream, and but my mother raised me, and my mother was someone who went to the eighth grade in Mississippi in an educational system that when cotton picking time came, she left school and picked cotton. So that was her background, but she had hopes of much, much better for me. And my mother raised me thinking that I was different from the other kids and that, by God, I'm going to make something of myself. And for my mother, that meant being a doctor or a lawyer. So I grew up different than the other kids in the neighborhood. And I'd go to the library. She would get me books from the library. And when I would come home with a report card and it had a B, or certainly, good God, don't have a C on there, she would say, what's going on here? Why aren't you doing better? So I think that was my driving force, and it changed me, and I think it led me to aspire to be the things that I eventually became.
What about the law, I asked him. Was there a moment when he was growing up when he discovered his calling?
No, I didn't. Really, I was a very naive young man, I grew up fulfilling my mother's wish for me. That's what I was doing. I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer because my mother wants me to be a doctor or a lawyer. I'm not sure I knew what either of them meant, and I think that the reason I went to law was that in college I took a few lab courses and I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor. I had no knack for it, and I think the study for that pre-med was not something that was for me, and so the other option was law. But again, I had never met a lawyer, and I didn't have the kind of background where I was really understood, and I didn't fully understand that really until I got in law school, and I'd go to class and the professor would ask a question, and certain members of my class would raise their hand and speak very knowledgeably about things in the law that were entirely new to me. And I spent that first year in law school, gee, I wonder how they know all of that, as I was learning. But so I played catch up to really get the grades I ended up getting. But I entered it pretty naively. I didn't understand what I was getting into. I didn't know there were lawyers that didn't go to court. They did other things. They handled investments and did all kinds of things that lawyers do. I learned that as I went.
Before going to law school, he spent some time in the military. How did that happen, I ask?
Well, it was very interesting. I was in ROTC as an undergrad, I went to Cal on a football scholarship, and I got hurt in my sophomore year, had a bad knee injury, and I really hated ROTC. I didn't like the discipline. I didn't like the whole thing about it. And so when I got hurt, I realized I didn't realize it, but I decided I was going to drop out of ROTC, which was Reserve Officers Training Corps. And I figured I wouldn't go into the Army. I was immediately classified 4F, which meant ineligible for the Army. When I graduated, I was accepted to Bolt Hall Law School, and I got a summer job when I graduated. I graduated, by the way, in January because I missed a semester because of my football injury. So I went down to L.A. and started working as a social worker and ready to go to law school when I got a draft notice. Been if I had stayed with ROTC.
Given the U.S. military's historic discrimination against African Americans, I asked him how he felt about going into the military.
I didn't like the military. It was very, very tough. And it was interesting, though. I think I got drafted, and as I said, by then I was a college graduate, and most of the people I was with were high school graduates who had joined the Army. And so I got treated a little differently. And as for the racist aspects of the Army, they were there, but our sergeant was a really tough black guy. So that wasn't racism there. That was just the Army. But the Army was a sludge for me. I went through it. I put up with it. Interviewing people that were sent into the clinical psych office and on the fort. I enjoyed that work, and I actually thought about, I liked it so much, I thought about becoming a clinical psychologist instead of a lawyer. But then when I realized I would have to go back to undergraduate and take some more courses to become a clinical psychologist, I stayed with law. That was a turning point in my life when I really thought what I wanted to do, rethought what I wanted to do.
He entered law school at UC Berkeley in 1959, and I asked him how unusual he was as an African American to be attending law school at Berkeley.
There were two African Americans in the class, me and another fellow named Eugene Swan. And it was the first class, we graduated in 1962, and it was the first class in Bolt Hall history in which two blacks graduated. It was not the first class in which two blacks attended, but it was the first class in which two blacks actually graduated from the law school. And there's been some research, and I believe that one of my friends who was also black and graduated from Bolt Hall did some research, and I think that I was something like the 10th or the 9th black, they weren't sure for some reason, to graduate from the law school. And that was in 1962.
I asked him whether he thought it was a little bit odd that there were so few other black students at UC Berkeley when he enrolled in the law school.
I thought that was quite odd, and I wasn't able to account for it. I thought it was strange. And indeed, I had a later experience some years later when I was running the legal aid office in East Palo Alto. One of the white students from East Palo Alto is right across the freeway from Palo Alto, where Stanford University is and Stanford Law School. I had a number of Stanford students working for me in the law office. And one day one of them said, and this was in 1968, that Sally Ann Payton was graduating and that she was going to be the first black in the history of Stanford Law School to graduate. By then, the difference between 1962 and 68, I'd had some life experience. And I thought at that point, how can that be? And I actually had the nerve to go over to the law school and talk to the dean about it. So I was very aware of that, Stanford first graduating one in 68, but I was much less aware of being the 8th or the 9th Bolt Hall in 1962.
So what, I asked him, was Berkeley like in the early 60s when he attended law school?
It was a new experience for me. It was the first time I had been away from L.A. For any meaningful period of time. And it was quite an experience. That I had gone through a primarily black school system in L.A., grammar school, junior high school I went to. My mother sent me across town for a better school, and that was mostly white kids. But then because I wanted to play football, and you can't play against your neighborhood team, I went to Jefferson High, which was primarily black. So it was quite an experience coming up to UC Berkeley. I have a picture upstairs there someplace where there were, in that large university, there were 14 black undergraduates in the entire university, undergraduate school. It was a different experience. I was used to a much rougher language kind of thing. You know, hey, man, what you doing? I'll kick your butt, ba-da-da-da. That was sort of the language of Jefferson High. And here people say, gee golly, feller, how are you doing? And it was, and I was adaptable. I wanted to succeed, and I sort of fell into that and just gloried in being a college student and hoping that I had some sort of future if I worked hard at it.
Given the scarcity of other black students at Berkeley, I asked him whether he created a narrative of himself as a pioneering figure at law school.
I don't think so. I don't think I saw myself as pioneering. I didn't have sufficient insight to think like that. I thought of myself as seizing the opportunity. And I think all of this says that I didn't really understand that larger world as well as I wish I had, that I saw myself as getting an opportunity to be a lawyer and to really do something and have, by whatever my accomplishments were, that the law schools weren't interviewing blacks. They weren't going to interview me. And I might add, for context, they also weren't, and many of them weren't interviewing women either. And we had a saying in our class that the number one person in our class was a woman, and she didn't get interviewed by the law firms. So that's when I became sort of mystified, and I had to change my view of what I was going to do. I wasn't going to go at the big firm and be a big lawyer, whatever that meant. And I realized that the way I was going to start my career was that, like other blacks had to do at the time, find a successful black lawyer, hook up with him, get a space in his, and I say him because there were no black female lawyers that I knew of at the time, pushed by Bobby Kennedy, who was the attorney general, to go around to government offices and push for diversity, have them put on their minds the need to diversify. And one day he was doing that, saying, how many blacks do you have working? And somebody said, how many blacks do you have working for you, Mr. Doar? And he realized that there were no blacks in the Civil Rights Division. Well, there was one by the time I got there. I was a second. I'm often depicted as the first, but I was actually the second. So he called his alma mater, which was Berkeley, and asked who was graduating, and the dean recommended me, and that changed the course of my life, and I started my career as an attorney for the Civil Rights Division rather than going back to L.A. or staying in Berkeley and starting work with a black law firm.
So I suggested we should be thanking Bobby Kennedy for Judge Henderson's glittering legal career.
Oh, very much, in a very real sense. Bobby Kennedy and also John Doerr, who became my mentor and savior when I did go there. Yes, very much. And to his having the insight that the government needed to diversify in those early days, in the early 60s.
At what point, I asked him, in the midst of all the assassinations and upheavals and student demonstrations, did Judge Henderson recognize that he was living in unusual times in the 1960s?
I think I didn't realize it until I really got to the Justice Department and started going out into the field. And I think it says more about me. I was a pretty naive, sheltered young man. I think that's what my mother did. I was a bookworm. I was a nerd. I don't think we had that word in our vocabulary, but I was a nerd at the school who actually did his homework and actually went home at night and did my homework at home and didn't go to the parties and, was kind of out of it in a way. So I was very unaware of a lot of things. But when I got to the Justice Department and they started preparing me to go out into the field, go down to Mississippi, to go down to Louisiana and go to Alabama to work on voting rights cases, they started letting me know that this was dangerous. They couldn't just send me out. And so I started getting, just informal coaching on what it's like down there and how I had to handle myself and what the dangers were. Then I became very aware that there was a whole different world down there, that the racism I read about sort of down south sort of becoming a reality, in which I started realizing it more. And over the time I was there, I got knee deep into it, or waist deep into it, I said, and saw really how very dangerous it was and what kind of dangers I was facing myself by going down there.
So what, I asked him, did he see in the American South when he visited it in the early 1960s as a civil rights lawyer?
Well, I got to know Medgar Evers. I became aware of him being assassinated. I used to hear the horror stories with Medgar Evers. I started seeing racism firsthand. I was arrested more than one time for driving while black. That's the only answer for it. But I think I can tell you, my first trip, it wasn't to Mississippi, but it was to Louisiana. My first trip, I got flown down to Shreveport. I got off the plane, went and got a rental car, and the head of the Louisiana unit had found a place for me to live in Shreveport, and I started heading for the motel that he found for me, and I drove about 15 minutes, and then I realized, I was so excited, I was anxious, that I'd forgotten to get my baggage at the airport. So I turned around. They had a brand new highway from the airport into town. I turned around and I was heading back to the airport, and almost immediately I saw a red light behind me. And I pulled over, and I got out of the car, and this cop came up to me with a gun drawn, put the gun to my head and said, "You got a knife on you, N-word." And really scared the crap out of me. And I didn't have a knife or a gun. and, you know, essentially terrorized me. And, excuse me, after realizing I didn't have a weapon, he eased up a bit and we started talking. And I found out I was from Berkeley. And he said, and this really influenced me years, Oakland Police Department. So I just got my insight by coincidences like that. I wasn't a very insightful guy, but I had the experiences, and some of these points eventually came to me of just how the world worked.
Did what he see and experience in the early 1960s in the American South, did it make him, I asked, feel ashamed to be an American?
It did. It triggered a sense of shame, embarrassment, and the cynicism of it. Even chances as you grow up, and there's deep racism, and I find it very disturbing. And we work hard to cover it up. And I understand that, but we're starting to deal with some of our past, but we still have to really have to come to grips with our past. Just this morning, I was thinking about this interview. I was reading the New York Times this morning, and there was an article about a black soldier who, I think it was 83 years ago, was killed by a military policeman. They covered it up as I read the story, and said he was killed in action, so he wasn't allowed for a burial with the other on a military. Making minor efforts like that to rewrite our past and undo a lot of the deep racism that most blacks have lived in during my lifetime. But the effort is slow and not as much as it should be. But wish I could be more articulate about that, but I hope that's an answer to your question.
And what about the debates within the African-American community between moderates and radicals, I asked? How did he view these kinds of conversations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was involved in them, very much so. And I was a keen observer of them. The debate, as I saw it, and looking back on it, I sort of was a Martin Luther King was a big hero of mine, and I think he played a major role in advancing civil rights in this country. But I also don't believe he could have been as successful were it not for the doing was reporting on my trips down south. I would report back in about my view of the dangers down there, what was happening, and what I think the black community's reactions were. And I think that the more likely that the black community was going to be violent or there was going to be gunfire, the more likely the department was going to take stronger actions. So I think that that helped Martin Luther King. He got a better ear from the Justice Department and from the government. Had not Malcolm X and the more militant people been threatening to take more violent actions than King did with his nonviolence.
I asked him whether he believed that 60s radicals like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael believed that the American law was capable of bringing justice.
The blacks are going to get the progress that they did, I think that was the reason for the, I gave a speech just recently about the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I think that is a direct product of the protests in Birmingham, the Children's Crusade there, and all of the movements that Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers and the others led.
When he looks back at the 1960s, I asked, what is he most proud of in terms of his accomplishments?
Well, I'm most proud of the fact that these protests actually led to something meaningful and tangible. As I said, in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which, meant that it was the beginning of the end of formal Jim Crow. No, formal laws that said whites only, and you can't eat at this lunch counter, and you have to ride in the back of the bus. It was the beginning of the end of that formal thing. Now, it was a big step forward, and I think that the 64 Civil Rights Act led to the 65 Voting Rights Act, I believe it was 65, and the 68 Housing Act. And those led to women, gays, disabled, others more assertively pursuing their rights too. I think it started a movement of improvement throughout. And Lyndon Johnson became president. To my pleasant surprise, he was a master politician, first of all, and he was a Southerner. And I think he believed that this was a chance for his legacy. He took the Civil Rights Act that became the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Kennedy had initially proposed it, and after he was assassinated, Lyndon Johnson took it up. And I Yeah, well, you know, it was a very interesting time politically, and John F. Kennedy had to deal with that. And I think one of the reasons he was moving slowly on civil rights was that he was a Democrat, and the Democrats were dominated by the Southern, you know, a significant number of the Democratic states were Southern, and he had to measure how far he was going to push civil rights with whether he was going to lose the Southern vote. So it was a very delicate balance there that he was trying to do. Very ironically, when Lyndon Johnson signed the 64 Civil Rights Act, he's quoted as having said, well, with this signing, the Democrats have lost the South for the next near future, or something like that. Sometime in the 1980s, I got a lawsuit that had to do with asking me to find that blacks were entitled to reparations. And I looked at that. I consulted with constitutional scholars at Stanford Law School, where I had friends, and at Bolt Hall, where I had friends. And the legal concept, it's been many years now, I don't precisely remember it, that they proposed in that lawsuit didn't support the notion of reparations. It's more of a moral issue than a legal issue, I think. But they now are talking about it more, and whether we will ever get there, I don't know, because there's so many forces now weighing against things like reparation. There's a whole movement, I think, which I'm going to call the colorblind movement, which is turning the law on its head. Affirmative action is now unconstitutional, according to this, that if you do something for blacks and you don't do it for whites, that's unconstitutional. You have to be colorblind in every way. And it's just, I think we're at that point where Martin Luther King famously said the progress of civil rights has been one of two steps forward and one step backward. And I think we're at that point where we're now maybe taking two steps backward in our progress along those lines. And I think that those steps backwards include any progress we might have made with reparations.
Given that the law is supposed to be colorblind, I ask, does he find it annoying that many people have remembered his career not just as a judge, but as an African-American judge?
It's annoying. It's disturbing only because, in the same way that the story I told a while back, when I learned that Stanford graduated its first black in 1962, that's annoying. Why haven't they done it before now? And the answer at that time was, we don't discriminate at Stanford. We'll take any black who has a 3.7 grade point average and a 97 percentile score on the LSAT. Well, nonsense. And I challenged him on that, and I said, let me see your last year of admissions and see, because he said we have to admit people we can live with. Well, they have something like legacy admittees. All you have to be for many is to have a parent who went to the law school. You know, so these are artificial barriers there. If you're really looking, you can find people that you can live with if you look at what you say you can live with. And they actually hired me, and I was there for 8 years setting up a minority admissions program for them on the basis of their own admissions records. So there are a lot of barriers that are put up that are quite artificial. And I think colorblindness, getting back to that, I think that's just a way of saying we're not going to do anything to help blacks. They're on their own. Now that we've been freed from slavery and the Jim Crow laws that we talked about earlier, they're on their own. They have to make it on their own. And then that is used against them because they say, okay, well, they still aren't making it. And there are no more Jim Crow laws, so it's their problem, their inadequacies. But I forget who it was, some famously said, this is like saying, okay, you're 10 yards behind, but we're all going to run a 50-yard dash. But here's where you are, blacks. You're going to end up starting 10 yards behind, and you're going to have to get to the finish line with the same, as fast as they are, because those are the things you've lived with all your life. So we haven't addressed those past prejudices that have held back minorities, people of color, and not just people of color, but people in the lower economic classes haven't had a fair shot at getting the, what's the thing when you're on a merry-go-round, getting the prize, whatever it is.
Given what he calls this 10-yard difference between blacks and whites in America, I asked, what does he think the best way is to create a truly level playing field in the America of the 2020s?
I think it's all of those things. I think that affirmative action was a good way to do it, which now is unconstitutional. I think it's political. I think that we need to give better economic opportunities. We don't fund schools in minority neighborhoods the same way we do in other schools because they're tied to property taxes and those kinds of things. I think you need to change all of those inequities so that everybody gets a fair chance. And it's not going to change it. I'm not naive enough to think that, okay, if we changed all of that tomorrow, all of these kids who grew up like kids I grew up with are going to say, I have a chance now, I'm going to aspire to go to Yale. That's not the way it works, but they will get some chance, and many of them will be taking taking advantage of those opportunities. And once they get that and it's handed down and there becomes a history, it's a long-range game, then it'll eventually even out. But that's the way you start it.
I asked him whether he agreed with Martin Luther King that the arc of history bends towards justice.
I do. Basically, I agree with them that it bends toward justice. But right now, it's hard to believe that because there's so much happening. And I believe most people will say it has something to do with race. I think it has more to do with race now than most commentators even are willing to admit to. It bends toward justice, but I think that with the MAGA movement and whatever that includes and implies, there's a great fear that whites are in danger of losing whatever it is that they have to minorities, that they're going to become a majority-minority kind of a thing, and it's driving some very bad things in this country that are not going to make Martin Luther King's dream a reality if they continue in the way they're going.
Some people might argue, I suggested, that Americans should be celebrating all the change. There's been a black president, black senators, black billionaires. Should we be celebrating these changes, I asked?
There seems to be a movement to stop the things that got me where I'm going. I have no doubt that I'm an affirmative action baby, that I got a lot of help along the way. I tried to pay back on it. I hope I have. And there have been a lot of people like that, but there aren't those opportunities. They're withdrawing those kinds of opportunities now. And I think that's bad. I think we need to continue in that direction, and the problem will eventually solve itself.
America will be 250 years old in 2026. Will he be celebrating that anniversary, I asked?
Oh, probably by looking at it and reading and talking to my friends about it. I don't think I'll be saying hip, hip, hooray and marching down the street or anything like that. I'll be celebrating. One thing that has given me insights that are very important, and despite the harshness of some of the comments I've been making to you, is that if you go to other countries, you'll get at least I got a different insight into this country. I went a number of years ago. I went with a group of judges and lawyers who had a State Department grant to go to other countries and show them the benefits of a jury system. And I got to other countries and I realized that, wow, we've got a lot of problems in the United States. But boy, we have so much more. And in so many ways, we're so much better than some of these other countries that we were visiting. And I remember visiting Bolivia and going down and seeing the indigenous people who were working in the mines. And we were trying to educate and saying, okay, here's the way a jury system would work here. And then talking to some of those indigenous people who could not imagine, as you talk to them, that they would be qualified to sit on a jury. And then you see the difference between our country and theirs. So I respect what we've done. All I'm saying is we could do a lot more, and we aren't perfect.
It is, of course, quite possible that in 2026, Donald Trump will once again be American president. And I asked Judge Henderson what his opinion would be of a second Trump presidency.
I would hope not, but he's getting more outspoken, more just saying what's on his mind now than ever before, and it's sort of frightening. And I have started, when I refer to him with my friends and we're talking about him and what would happen, I somehow feel that he Mein Kampf is his playbook. So much of what he's doing, and we're starting to see it in the public commentary, is seems to be patterned after Adolf Hitler's march to power in Germany. So it's a very frightening thought that what he has done. And I always ask my friends, how many times have you said, okay, he's crossed the line, and he hasn't crossed the line. He just keeps going. Nothing stops him with his base. He's got a base that it's a frightening thought to me.
And finally, we talked about America's long-term future. What should it prioritize, I asked, in the 50 years after 2026?
I think the great challenge for America, and right now they're going in the exact opposite direction, is to fess up to where we are and to what we've done and to what our past is, and honestly dig in to solve that and really become what we say we are, land of opportunity, home of the free and the brave and those kinds of things, equal justice for all. Really start a move toward that and not have hidden below it, but we really only mean for white men or white males or this kind of thing, or this would, when we're saying that, we really just mean for upper class people and middle class people, but live up to what our deal that we wrote in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and be true to it, and allow at the same time, instead of suppressing, as they seem to be doing in Florida, just books that tell us about our history and the slave past, let it be learned and live with it and then work on it to change that history and make it not a part of the present. That's what I think we need to do. I don't see it happening right now. We're going in an opposite direction. But I think if we did something that simple, we'd continue to be the great country we've always been.